Spent last week in Washington, D.C. with my, I went up there to visit the Baptist World Alliance and the 21st Century Wilberforce organizations. They're located just outside Washington, D.C., and I got to tour the facilities and meet with some of their personnel. Also, a week ago tonight, they had snow on the ground, and Washington, D.C. shuts down when it has snow. I mean, it's, we don't get that much snow here, but I felt like a city that far north would have the equipment and the means to navigate. New York does, and Boston does, and Chicago does, and Philadelphia does. The nation's capital, they just would assume shut down and call it in. Maybe I should appreciate that. I don't know. But Wednesday was a snowy, snowy day. Was a good week. We have a member here at our church who is connected with, friends with, the chief of staff for the Department of Health and Human Services, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And so I got to meet him and got a West Wing tour, which was a first. I've been to D.C. a number of times. Never got to see the Oval Office in all of its grandeur, or the press room, for that matter. But anyways, it was good to be there. The organizations I met with, they do a lot dealing with religious freedom. They're doing advocacy in and around D.C. with our politicians as well as foreign dignitaries on matters pertaining to religious freedom here in our country as well as religious freedom in other parts of the world. They've done a lot of work in Nigeria of late, a lot of work in Iraq, paying a lot of attention to China. Obviously, a lot of attention in Venezuela, a lot of attention with the, in Myanmar, Burma, the people group, the, yes, thank you, the Rohingyas. So it's not just religious freedom for Christians. I mean, they're religious freedom organization for all people. But we may have an opportunity to hear more and learn more about them and their work in the days to come. So, this week we're obviously meeting. Next week we're meeting. The week after is spring break. So we'll take a break 2 weeks from tonight. And
So next week we will.
Oh, thank you. Ash Wednesday next week, then spring break. So we'll take a 3 week break. Yeah, 1, 2, 3. Thank you. I knew my days are running together. So I told Garrett he could either introduce wisdom literature or do Song of Songs, and you see what's on your notes tonight. So all well and good. Song of Songs is the Hebrew name. It's the same vernacular that you're familiar with when the temple language speaks of the Holy of Holies. There were not superlatives in the Hebrew language, and so the way that you said good, better, and best is you said holy, holy, holy. And so the Song of Songs is, and the Holy of Holies is a way of saying the most holy of holies. The Song of Songs is the most songly of songs, the most beautiful of songs. The Hebrew text does open up. It says the Song of Songs, which is Le Shelomo. This is under title B. Based on the first verse, the Song of Songs, which is Le Solomon. The particle lamed or le at the beginning of a Hebrew word sometimes means from, sometimes it means by, sometimes it means of or about. It's the same challenge we have when we go to Psalms. And a psalm will say, this is a psalm of David. Well, what does of David mean? Does it mean David wrote it? Does it mean it was written about David? Does it mean it was written in the spirit of David? Does it mean it was written for David's honor? And so the same goes here. The Song of Songs of Solomon. But does that mean Solomon wrote them? Does it mean it was written for him? Does it mean it was written about him? Does it mean it was written in his spirit or by, you know, wisdom writers in the vein of or in memory of? We don't really know, but it's kind of carried the title of Song of Solomon through more of Christian tradition because we like to tag it with Solomon. There's a little bit of a mythos there behind Solomon who had, which is peculiar to me, that we have this book that's all about courtship and marriage and romantic love, and we want to tie it to Solomon who, whether it's literal or slight exaggeration, you know, was given 1,000 women in his life between his wives and his mistresses. Doesn't really, Song of Solomon is much more, we would be much more comfortable with Song of Songs, probably, than we would be with Solomon's marital patterns. We don't know if he wrote it. We do know that it is in some way connected with Solomon, either in his memory or as a byproduct of his reign. So the Song of Songs is a title that I tend to prefer. It is commonly called the Canticles, which we don't usually use that in English. That's more of a Latin or maybe a Catholic reference, which is just a word that means song, the Canticles. Canticum Canticorum, which is Latin for Song of Songs. Yeah. Its placement in the Hebrew canon is with the writings. We're tagging it as a subset of the writings, which is the poetry. Lamentations, Psalms, Song of Songs are the three predominantly poetic books. But you see there that the Hebrew people also categorize it in the Megaloth, the five books that are read at the five Jewish feasts. And the Song of Songs was read at Passover. I think we mentioned this a couple of weeks back when we did Lamentations. Was read at Passover, which might seem peculiar when we get down to genres of literature and the history of interpretation. Maybe you'll pick up a little bit on why that happens to be. So, considerable controversy over its canonization. Yeah, you see there the conservative rabbinic school. I pulled Palestinian off of a note from somebody else. The rabbinical school of Shammai opposed the inclusion of Song of Songs. They were conservative. They felt like this was a little much to be included. The more liberal school of Hillel, based in Babylon instead of in the land of Canaan, they supported placing it in the canon. And obviously history has favored the school of Hillel. You got any more insight on Hillel and Shammai and their debates over this? Even still, you know, if you're on big university campuses, you know, you'll see Christian organizations, you know, Baptist Student Union, BSM. If there were campuses that had Jewish organizations, I remember around the University of Oklahoma, they had a house for Hillel. I don't know if they had one for Shammai, but it was just kind of a, these names of these rabbis are identified as key entities still in the life of modern Orthodox Judaism. So, key rabbinical figures during the intertestamental period. Were they intertestamental or first century? First century? Yeah.
So were the argument for canonization and non-canonization primarily based on the context and the romantic context?
Yeah. What I have read and heard is that is the primary reason. Yeah. Now some and some have said that the primary reason for inclusion was because of its association with Solomon. And so, you know, if we tag Proverbs to Solomon, if we tag, then, you know, we've identified him as authoritative. And so, but I don't really know a whole lot more than just those big rocks. There may be some other detailed issues. In Jewish history and in Christian history, teachers have not really known what to do with this particular writing. They've not known how to handle it. They've not known what to do with it. And in large part, it's theorized, and whether this goes back to Plato or not, the reality is the case that the church has largely been uncomfortable talking about human sexuality. We see evidence of that today in the scandals that the Catholic Church is dealing with, in the Houston Chronicle reports about churches in the Southern Baptist Convention. The church has often, the religious communities have often suppressed this matter of human relationship, and it has usually cost them because it plays itself out in harmful ways instead of fruitful ways. But early on, I suspect their reasoning was largely, seems a little explicit to us, and so we're not sure we want to put it in there.
And I know you're going to talk about this more, but the idea of it being a love letter to God.
Right.
Is one of the simple primary.
That's how they get around it. We're going to make this an allegory, so it's about God and us, and that's the way we get around it. I don't know, that to me that might make it a little bit, I might be more uneasy with that interpretation than the other, but that does bring us to, you know, this big question, what genre of literature are we dealing with when we come to the songs? Listen, even as being an Old Testament scholar, I have a hard time with the Song of Songs. And it's not because it's relatively romantic and explicit. It's because the literature itself is challenging. It doesn't give us a lot of clues. Sometimes it's changing. Even there are parts where in Hebrew you can tell if it's a female speaking or if it's a male speaking because they have masculine and feminine gender in their verbs. If any of you have taken other languages like Spanish or French, you know, you get that. English, we don't. We have the same verb system whether you're male or female. And so reading in our Bibles, sometimes you can't even pick up on where it changes from the female speaking to the male speaking. Sometimes study Bibles will put headings in there, but sometimes the headings are broken at places that make it even more confusing to read. And so I have challenges with Song of Songs for totally different reasons, and it usually borders on genre and structure, which I've given you a chart on the back. What genre of literature are we dealing with here? This is perhaps the key question and most debated issue surrounding the book. What are we dealing with? Is it? We've talked about it as though it's just poetry. Is it as easy as that? Is it as simple as saying this is poetry? In much of Jewish and Christian tradition, the book has been interpreted as an allegory. This is God and God's people. And the romantic relationship, the courtship, the marriage, all of this is speaking about God and his relationship with his people. Now, it would far be it from me to make light of centuries of interpretational tradition in Christianity and in Judaism. But whenever I read Song of Songs, I think that you really, really have to stretch hard in order to make that interpretational leap. Now remember, we're reading very far into the world of Western Enlightenment and rationalism, and much of our religious forerunners were not. They were in more primitive thinking societies, more primitive operating societies, and so making that leap, whereas we might have a much harder time, maybe they did not. You also have the fact that the scriptures up until 500 years ago were controlled by the priesthood, whether it was the Catholic or Orthodox priesthood or whether it was the Jewish priesthood. The leaders controlled the scriptures, and so probably most of the common folks wouldn't have even known about this. The practice of reading the megaloth at the Jewish festivals, I think, originated in the 8th century AD. I think I read that somewhere. And so even that doesn't go back, you know, to the time of Christ or the Roman Empire. But the only time people might have access to the Song of Songs was on Passover whenever it was read. But that's been the way, you know, religious, you know, leaders and teachers have kind of skirted around the issue. We've made it something that seems more palatable to us. And you can make of that what you will. Yeah. That is one reason. Yes. Yes. Time of year in spring, but also God's love for his people. Yeah, because the Passover was God's deliverance, his coming and meeting his people and entering into this covenant and delivering them from Egypt. And Song of Songs is interpreted to be a statement of God's love for his people, entering into a marital style relationship with them. So, yes. There's not much consensus, is there? Yeah, there really isn't. And so, so that's a lot of tradition. Now, more the last couple of hundred years, so this is not brand new. Within the last couple of hundred years, you've had a lot of Christian readers and interpreters that have kind of started moving back towards, yes, it's love poetry, but it's not allegorical. This is just poems in adoration of, you know, the romantic love amongst humans. Part of what's helped that a little bit is archaeological excavations have pulled up a lot of other examples of love poetry in the ancient world, and there are similarities. In particular with Egyptian examples. Descriptions of the body, starting at the head, working down to the feet, your hair looks like this, your nose like this, your teeth like this, moving all the way down. You see there's examples in ancient Sumer, which go back much later, ancient Ugarit, ancient Egypt. And so these examples tell us that Song of Songs was a type of literature that was at home in the ancient Near Eastern world, and unless they were all doing it allegorically, there was something common in the ancient world about writing poems the way that we write love songs. In every culture there have been these ways of writing poetry about one's beloved, and we tend to put them to music more often than not now than maybe a century ago, but that's not a new trend. There are some, particularly in Song of Songs, because you've got multiple characters. You see there on D, the nature of the dialogue between two persons has caused some to call this an early example of a drama, like a theatrical drama. The problem is that we really don't have any other hard examples of there being a genre of theatrical drama until you get to ancient Greece. It seems like this was a development of Hellenism. And so here we comes into dating. If you want to date the Song of Songs into the 2nd century, 3rd century BC, then maybe. If we want to date it much closer to the time of Solomon, 9th century, 8th century, then we don't think that there really was such a thing as drama. It does, just because you have two characters and they're playing off of each other doesn't mean this was written for the stage or really written to be acted out. And it reads, it's very kind of hodgepodge. You'll read one part and there's dialogue, and you read another part, there's a monologue. Part of the challenge for me is just a level of consistency running all the way from start to finish. Yeah. Yeah, you would think. What I thought you might were going to ask is, does it imply it was supposed to be a singular song, a singular unit, or a collection of multiple, Yeah. Right. Out of this book.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But, again, I do think that it implies probably a musical background, the same way the Psalms would. And so the fact that it's used that way today would be evidence to that point. When we're thinking about, structure and forms, the question of, are we dealing with something that's designed to be read start to finish as a singular work? Or are we dealing with something like the Book of Psalms, which is a collection of different, pieces, so to speak? And I don't really know that I know the answer to that.
But there would have been like fallen upon songs already, right?
Probably. Yeah, probably. Probably so. Yeah. Dating this is really tough too. And so the answer to that question is partially also the same answer to the drama question. Is this a second century work or is this a ninth century work? And you have people all over the map that have different opinions on that. The book that you guys, if you guys bought the book, he spends more time talking about authorship and date. I didn't put a lot of that on here. I don't know that it advances our understanding a great deal for interpreting the book. But, you know, look, there clearly are characters in the Song of Songs. I put that on the notes. Scholars are not sure if there are two of them or if there are three. And so you have different ways of reading this. You'll have one scholar that's a very common approach, reads a bridegroom and a bride, and would even go so far as to say that the groom is Solomon and that the bride is the Shulamite woman. And then maybe they'll push it even much further and say that she was a woman who he was so enamored with that it turned him from his very polyamorous ways. Of course, the challenge with a lot of this is it's not in the text. I mean, you can't pull that out of the text of Song of Songs. We do see Solomon mentioned in one. He's mentioned by name, I think, in one passage. The woman is identified as a Shulamite in one passage. But these are not common references. Another interpretation sees in the male voices two characters, and so they would suggest that there are three played out here. There's the woman, there is her lover, and there is the king, who has the rival who has seized her into his courts, and she refuses to give her heart to him. Until at the end, finally, he relents and gives her back to her beloved. Maybe you can kind of piece that together, but that's, you really have to work hard to connect the dots on that one as well. Yeah, Judy? Yeah. So that probably what it's approaching, it's probably implying that we're dealing with a collection of poems instead of one singular work. Listen, I tend to lean that way. I tend to lean that this is a collection of poems written about love. They are structured together, but, you know, all kinds of questions are raised about that are really, really hard to answer if we treat this as a linear event. We're starting at the beginning and we're working our way linearly through the process of courtship and marriage and consummation and family. When you do all of that, it sure seems like there's a lot of amorous activity going on early on, all the way through. And people have had to try and answer the question, and, you know, it seems like there's a lot going on here before the marriage actually happens. If it's a collection of love poems, then that the sequential nature of the writing is it's not present, so you don't have to answer those questions quite so stringently, I guess. Yes?
So, I mean, first time I ever read this, I didn't have any training about what everybody thinks, which sometimes that's a blessing. But I just talked about the Christian being the bride of Christ, I just thought that this related to that. So it's consummated.
Yeah. Yeah. Clearly not, Nate, because thousands and thousands and millions of people have done the same. I think, you know, you identified a portion of it that's a little bit easier to see that. You know, whenever you go, when we get to forms on the notes here, one of the forms you see are these descriptive summaries. There's two of them pertaining to the woman. There's one of them pertaining to the man. And they, you know, they are in praise of the physical appearance of the beloved. And, you know, can be as simple as hair and teeth. You know, you look so pretty, you have all your teeth in your face. But there's also a lot of imagery in here that pertains to sexuality, male and female parts, the act of intimacy and procreation.
Sexuality is used in the scriptures.
And right.
It's not just about sex.
True.
It's about faithfulness and, you know, before we're all glorified, I mean, we're all fickle there. We're all just
true.
This way and that way. We pray and then we don't pray. We get into sin and we come back and renew ourselves. And I also think that the way the woman is described, I think the Lord sees us that way. He loves us so much like a bride.
Yeah.
Is there any connection between Hosea's theme and this theme?
Well, that's a good question, Todd. And how I would answer your question, Nate, or your observation is, if in the process of interpreting, that seems to be the natural interpretation of the text, which in Hosea it clearly is, that Hosea and his relationship with his wife, it's overtly stated, this is designed to be a symbolic picture of my love for my people. I think if we're interpreting Song of Songs that way because we're uncomfortable with the nature of human sexuality and we're trying to avoid that in these passages, I think that says more about us than it does about God or about the texts themselves. So, but again, I told you, this is one of the more challenging books, not just because of explicit content. It is all across the board. Yeah. Well, and it can be in English too. Let me finish the notes and then we'll look at some text examples.
We actually know someone who came to the Lord by reading the Psalms.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the end of the day, I mean, you can see patterns of God and his plan of salvation and his work towards that end. You can see that written throughout the Old Testament. And so if you see shadows, echoes of that even here. This is the nature of being an Old Testament scholar. What I find most often is New Testament readers want to take the Old Testament and strip it of anything except where it points to Jesus and points to the New Testament. And in doing so, they rob it of a lot of its primary meaning and primary value. If in reading the Old Testament, this is Isaiah and, you know, Emmanuel, the baby who will be Emmanuel. The primary context of that was not a messianic prophecy. The primary context was a deliverance from the Assyrian army that was marching on Jerusalem. But in that story, you find a great deal. Yeah, that was the first fulfillment. And then you had a greater or a second fulfillment later on. But if you tell most people, you know, Emmanuel's primary referent was likely one of the sons of Isaiah, they act like you're guilty of heresy. And that's really not the case. It just forces you to expand, you know, in the same way that we would say, well, Jesus, the writer of Hebrews does this very, very well when he says, you know, Jesus is a fulfillment of the priesthood. But to appreciate that, you have to understand the priesthood. Jesus is a fulfillment of the sacrificial system, but to understand that, you have to understand the sacrificial system. The writer is not trying to replace the Old Testament institutions. He's saying, these are the Old Testament institutions. This is what they teach us, and look how Jesus perfects those. I like that process much more so because it takes the Old Testament at face value and pulls out of it what it's designed to communicate. I would say no.
3:15?
Yeah, I would say no. Not everywhere. In many places. The Father. I mean, so here, the challenge in our modern day Christianity is we want to We acknowledge the Trinity, but we really want to pull Jesus out and say everything in the Bible points to Jesus. And then we miss out on the fact that much of the Bible also is speaking to the character of the Father. The role of the Holy Spirit also is even more underplayed in modern Christianity. Yeah. Yeah. That's not to say there's not a lot. Right.
I mean, it seems to me there should be much more emphasis put on the Father and on the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And so, and I agree with you there, but when I say Jesus, I mean the action of the Trinity together.
Oh, well, yeah. The plan of salvation, God's work, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Imagery and forms real quick, and then we'll look at some examples. The variety of forms, and that's part of the challenge with reading it as a single linear poem, is you'll have descriptive summaries, you'll have dialogue at times, you'll have monologue at times. You do have the voice of the male, the voice of the female, and then you kind of have these voices of the plural, the masses, the crowd, the attenders at the wedding, the people in the streets. On a couple of instances, the woman goes looking for her lover and she can't find him, and she asks the watchman on the wall, have you seen him? And then you have these expressions of desire, expressions of admiration. The second thing to identify is imagery that's used. And the songs, this is important because whether you're looking at love poetry from Egypt, love poetry from Babylon, from Sumer, from the Middle Ages, from modern America, people use imagery to talk about their love that is culturally based, things that they see in the world around them. And if you're like me, you've probably seen countless mockeries of the descriptive summaries in Song of Songs, where the woman is her neck is like a Tower of David and her hair is like a flock of goats. And we kind of joke at those, but you do, who said it was beautiful, Ricky? You do kind of have to, you have to get the cartoonish, you know, your cheeks are like pomegranates. You have to get some of the cartoonish ways that we look at those as Westerners out of your mind and think a little bit more like a primitive agrarian, you know, ancient resident and identify what they're talking about, you know, that your teeth look like shorn sheep. I don't know that that's a compliment that will get you very far today, but I mean, it's speaking to long flowing curly hair. It's speaking to white, you know, shining teeth. It's speaking to lovely form and beautiful skin. And you could come to songs, poems that are, you know, written or sung today, and we do the exact same thing. We just pull imagery from our world. They pulled imagery from their world. So it's interesting. If you got the book, he gives a couple of examples of an Egyptian poem, I think one of a Sumerian one, and they use some that are similar, but they also pull imagery from different contexts that would have been unique. Remember, ancient Sumer was probably a thousand years before the time of Abraham. You're jumping back a millennium. And Egypt, you know, well, you see on the notes that the Egyptian ones are dated to 1100 to 13, 1300 to 1100 BC. That's a few centuries ahead of Solomon. And or concurrent with, yeah, depending on how you date the flood. But the imagery in the biblical Song of Songs comes from the royal court. The Egyptian one also uses royal court a lot. Family life, you'll notice, they speak to each other as brother and sister at times. Nature, obviously, lots of references to nature. Time and space, they talk about proximity, farness, nearness. Lots of references to the mother's house, to the chamber, bedroom, to running through the streets, to looking for, you know, looking for your lover. Also military references. So, and then in case you didn't buy the book, I've given you some examples of how three different scholars have tried to mark out the structure of the Song of Songs. The third one down there, Golder, that's probably the best example of somebody trying to make this a linear account. And you look through there, there's an arrival, the audience, the courtship, in the night, the procession, the wedding, the consummation, a knock at the door, a lover lost and found, the one and only, the dance, a night in the country. The first and second one are more structural kind of parallels with Shay. It's an A, B, C, and then an A prime, B prime, C prime. With Cheryl Exum, it's a chiasm where it flows to the middle and then flows back out again. The parallels are in concentric order. So anyways, enough said about all of that. Let's look at Song of Songs. I sat and read through all of it this afternoon. It took me maybe 20 minutes. And I was reading it pretty slowly and methodically. So it's not long. It is 8 chapters. But Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs. My study Bible, it has these names, Beloved, the Friends, Beloved, the Lover. It doesn't even identify them by genre, which is not helpful to me. I don't know if any of your Bibles have subheadings. And if the Lover and the Beloved. Yeah. It opens with the woman. The woman is the one who starts it, verse 2, 3, and 4. So whatever your study Bible calls the one speaking in chapter 1, verse 2, 3, and 4, that's the female. And much of the primary speaking in Song of Songs is done by the woman. The male's role is very minimal. There's one scholarly work that goes to the sections in Proverbs where advice, mother is giving advice to her son about marriage and, you know, courtship and things like that. Or maybe it's a dad giving advice to his son. And they've kind of listed this as a parallel. That in Proverbs you have is advice to the boys. In Song of Songs you have advice to the girls on how this, you know, how this can play out. So, you ever heard that before, Ricky? I want to say Proverbs 6 and 7, but I don't recall exactly. You know, Solomon's Song of Songs, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes, your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you, take me away with you. Let us hurry, let the king bring me into his chambers. These subheadings do help when you go to plural. We rejoice and delight in you, we will praise your love more than wine. And a lot of these, I mean, they're admirations, they're, you know, this little flirting that goes back and forth. There's attempts to kind of steal one away for some kind of a rendezvous in a couple of counts. one of the descriptive summaries is in chapter 2. Actually, there's a couple of male descriptive summaries. The one I was looking for is the female one in chapter 4. How beautiful you are, my darling. Your eyes behind your veil are like doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. That might have sounded gorgeous in the ancient world. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn coming up from the washing. Each has its twin, not one of them is alone. That's the part I find humorous, is not that it compares them to shorn sheep, but it makes such a big deal of them all they're all being there. Yeah, they're all there. Your lips like a scarlet ribbon, your mouth is lovely, your temples behind your veil. This is chapter 4. Yeah, I know. There's a lot everywhere. This is one of the female descriptive summaries, one of the first. There's a male one in chapter 2, verse 3, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest. Yeah. My dove in the clefts of the rock and the hiding places on the mountainside, show me your face, let me hear your voice. Yeah. Some of the recurring themes, one of them is, you see there in chapter 2, verse 16. My lover is mine and I am his. There are two or three places where it kind of speaks to this It may be pushing a little bit far to say this is an advocation of monogamy, but some have made that so. My beloved is mine, and I am his. Yeah. Which is, if that is indeed the case, would be very contra King Solomon. But that is one of those thematic observations. Another one that comes up three times I know is, let's see if I can find the first one. The group is telling the woman, or the woman is responding, basically telling people to let sleeping love lie until it's time. That's it.
It says it a couple of times.
It says it three, I think. Yeah. Y'all find any examples? I thought there was one in chapter 1 or 2. There's one early.
2:7?
Yeah. You got it. Thank you, Nate. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. I think it mentions it again, maybe in the last chapter and somewhere in the middle. 3:5. You've got good study Bibles that link them. Chain reference.
That same idea is even after they are married.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a beautiful thought for me.
Yeah.
To have that kind of respect. So, like, you know, just because a man is married to the woman doesn't mean it's take her any time.
Right.
And that was a thought that I got on.
Yeah. And that, I mean, in agreement with you, but keep in mind, I think all three times when that's referenced, it's in the voice of the woman speaking to the other women. Daughters of Jerusalem. Yeah. Ricky.
He uses the word Rayati, which means my wife, but not Ishti, because Ishti can be in plural.
Okay.
In the Shokai, and then you have a lot of women.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, this is an NIV, so I wouldn't trust it a lot on fine grammatical details. 6:4 in the NIV says, "You are beautiful, my darling, as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem, majestic as troops with banners." My wife. Okay. That is my darling. That's an unusual English translation. why they would translate it as darling. That's kind of a vernacular word. I don't know that there's a Hebrew equivalent for darling. Yeah. Yakirati. My darling, yeah. My beloved, my... But you say it's a term of endearment for a wife. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha. The sentiment about, you know, do not awaken love, do not arouse love, I mean, I think largely it's speaking to youth, you know. Don't push kids into, you know, romantic ideas and romantic places until it's time, because once you're there, it's hard to go back. It's hard to go back. And that could be, that could be from sexuality, that could be from dating, that could be from, I mean, that can be in any domain. It's, you know, let it happen naturally. But I mean, yeah, the earlier, you know, that you start talking about those things, you begin to awaken them and develop them, and you're right, once you go down that road, there's usually no going back. So where are we at? 7:05. You know, at the end you've got a couple of peculiarities, and even if much of the book I could come around to thinking it's a linear sequence. Like chapter 8, verse 8, 8, 9, 10. And see, even the break in the speech, doesn't identify this as a unit, but 8, 9, 10 almost stand apart as a separate poem. It's brothers. We have a young sister. Her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her, but if she is a door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar. It feels perhaps a little crass. I think what the brothers are saying is we're going to guard her until she is of age. We're going to protect her and defend her. But then the sister apparently speaks out and says, I am a wall, my breasts are like towers, thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. And then between verse 10 and 11, there's really a break. It moves to a different idea. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon. He let out his vineyard to tenants. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver, but my own vineyard is mine to give. The 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon, and 200 are for those who tend its fruit. Those who would say that this is the king who has pulled this maiden in, that ultimately he releases her to go back to her beloved, it's in that vineyard poem that they see Solomon finally relenting, that she would say that there's a lot of the natural imagery that is, what's the word we call them? Why can't I think of the word? It's the more profound way of saying that we're using metaphors to talk about body parts and talk about sex. There's a lot of secondary nuances and meaning in the imagery here, and vineyard being one of them. It's really, really obvious. I'm sorry? Thank you. Well, that's not the word I was looking for, but that is also what we're dealing with here. Yeah. I cannot think of that. It's like when the angels, they're flying, they've got six wings, and with two they're covering their face, and with two they're covering their feet. Yeah, and feet is a... Oh, man. I am already starting to lose it. It is in Isaiah, but they use that when they talk about that feet is often used as a euphemism. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. As a euphemism. So you see that really obviously. I think it's at the end of... It's the passage that he identifies as consummation, 4:8 to the end of chapter 4. Spring. This is chapter 4, verse 12. You were a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You were a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes. You are a garden, a fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. And the beloved says, awake, north wind, and come, south wind. Blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. That's about as obvious of euphemistic kinds of language as you can get. And so, using that as an example, when you come back around to the end of chapter 8, and Solomon had a vineyard, he let out his vineyard to tenants. Well, we know Solomon had lots of wives and lots of, handmaidens as well, concubines. But my own vineyard is mine to give. The 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon. 200 are for those who tend its fruit. You who dwell in the gardens with friends in attendance, let me hear your voice. Come away, my lover, be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains. That's another point, as they say. It seems like a peculiar ending if we're going start to finish. Although it's not a peculiar ending if what you have here is just another poem added to a collection of poems.